I'm Patricia Pierce. Welcome to the Evolutionary Activist Podcast. We are living at an important moment in our history, a time that is calling us into a new way of being, a new consciousness from which a sustainable, just, and peaceful future can arise. In this podcast, we explore ways to help that future take hold within ourselves so that together we can help it come forth in our world. Our guest today is Peter Fikowski, who is an MIT graduate in physics and a technology entrepreneur who holds 27 patents. In recent years, Peter has been focusing on restoring a healthy climate for future generations. He is co-founder of the Healthy Climate Alliance, which connects and supports key communities around climate restoration. And he's a board member of 300 by 2050, which links potential funders with climate restoration practitioners. Peter has participated in the Vatican's Laudato Si Climate Restoration Conference and has participated on a panel at the UN General Assembly focusing on climate restoration. I had the opportunity to meet Peter in 2017 at a small gathering of religious and spiritual leaders who were exploring ways to activate the religious imagination around the vision of a restored climate. Thank you, Peter, so much for being with us today. And I would like to launch in by having you tell us, what do you mean when you say climate restoration?
Patricia, thank you so much for inviting me and having me here. Climate restoration is this. We all want to give our children the same climate our grandparents had 100 years ago. And we know that to fulfill an ambitious project like climate restoration, you need to have a specific goal, a what and by when. That's how we went to the moon. That's how the Millennium Development Goals were fulfilled. And so on. That's how you build a house. You say what you want and when you want it, have it finished. So for climate restoration, we went through and defined it as getting the atmosphere back to what it was 100 years ago. So getting CO2 below 300 parts per million by the year 2050.
And why is 2050 the magic year that we're aiming for?
It's poetic. It's the middle of the century. If we wait much longer than that, then our generation, I think we're both boomers, if we waited till 2080, we could say, well, let our children do it. We'll do some more opinion pieces about it.
So taking generational responsibility.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, these goals, how are they different from the Paris Agreement?
In a way, it's very different. The Paris Agreement picked 2 degrees and then 1.5 degrees as goals, with no particular reason other than they seemed like reasonable ones. We started with the premise that the reason that the customer for climate restoration is humanity. And then given that, our goal is to increase the probability of the survival of future generations. And once you say that, then this goal of getting CO2 back below 300 doesn't get any argument, because humans have never before lived at CO2 levels above 300 parts per million. And we might, but we might not. And I don't think any of us really want to take a chance on our future generations if we have a choice.
Now, you have called, first of all, let me say that I think for a lot of people, and I would put myself in this category before I met you, think about climate mitigation or how can we adapt to a warming climate. But you are coming at it from a very different perspective, and you're saying that we can do way better than that. We can actually restore the atmosphere, the climate, to what it was when our grandparents were alive. Are you finding that this idea of climate restoration, and we'll talk more about, you know, how that might be accomplished, but do you find that this idea that we can actually do more than just minimizing our emissions and actually drawing CO2 out of the atmosphere, is that getting some currency? Is that getting on the radar of more people as a possibility?
Yes, it definitely is. We've been fairly strategic and talking to the critical parties, which are the UN. The UN created the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, as a set of 2,000 or 3,000 climate scientists around the world who were declared to be the official experts on the climate. And so, as long as they have been saying that we need to cause less damage, that has been the official marching orders for our planet, really. And we want to change that, because 2 degrees, I don't think, is survivable. And given the disasters we have now at just 1 degree, with the hurricanes and the wildfires and the cold and the heat and the droughts,
yes.
I shouldn't be laughing, but to think that at 1.5 degrees it might be tolerable seems mistaken. And so, there's a feedback loop in terms of opinions. And so the scientists, and I'm a MIT educated physicist, my friends at MIT say, well, restoring the climate is good, but the UN hasn't made that a goal. And then when I go to my friends at the UN, they say climate restoration is great, but the scientists aren't talking about it yet. And so we've been breaking that gridlock. And we have strong enthusiasm from up and down the UN, up and down the technical fields. And the thing we're working on now is getting publications. And of course, this interview is a good move in that direction.
And I noticed in the UN climate report that just came out, they're talking about climate restoration. It was actually, from what I read, being talked about. So yes. Congratulations on actually getting this on the table as something for us to think about collectively. You have likened this situation and this vision to the moon
yes.
landing. And tell us about the similarities that you see between that endeavor and what we're looking at now.
Well, there's several. One of them is that it's critical to set a goal, a specific goal. And what we've been doing on climate up till now is saying, well, try to avoid the worst aspects. Now, what is the worst aspects of climate change? That's undefined. Try to avoid, that's undefined. So it doesn't call for powerful action. And it makes a lot of room for argument. On the going to the moon, President Kennedy said in 1961, we'll land a man on the moon and bring him back safely by the end of the decade. And so that was very clear. Land him on the moon, bring him back safely by the end of the decade. And we did that in 8 years.
And oh, by the way, we had no idea how to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we had ideas. We said, yeah, rockets can get us into space. But what's amazing is we were using slide rules back in 1961. There were almost no computers. And so the engineers deciding this. Now, most of your listeners probably don't even know what a slide rule is, but it's just a mechanical device you use for doing multiplication, because there weren't any computers back then.
Yes, or calculators when you're taking physics in
yes.
school. Yeah, so I'm really intrigued by this comparison of restoring our climate to our generation's visionary collective goal.
Yeah.
And that when we have the will and we put forth that vision and we claim that vision, then we mobilize the things that we need to bring it about. And so coming at this as a scientist, can you give us just a few examples of the sorts of things that might be developed that would help? And again, let me just clarify for listeners that we're talking really, are we not, about extracting CO2 from the atmosphere?
Yeah, Let me back up just a little bit. What's one of the interesting things about the Moon program is you and I, we were young at the time, and pretty much all we did was cheer NASA on and the scientists and our friends who went off to engineering and science to help that program out. We actually did practically nothing ourselves to fulfill the Moon mission. And it turns out that with climate restoration, it's quite analogous. That in contrast to mitigation, where everyone can drive less, eat less meat, replace your LED bulbs, and so on, restoration, as you'll hear in a few minutes, is mostly something that a few specialists, corporations, experts, maybe government groups, but some numbers of thousands of people deeply involved in it, but they need the cheering section of humanity to move forward. And again, that's why you haven't heard about it yet, because we're right now developing the cheering section to say, let's do it. And in a minute, you're ready to ask me questions about how do we do it. I'll tell you about what that will look like.
Yes, yes. So I love that we can be the cheering section. To really move this forward. So if you want to give us just a couple of examples of the sorts of things that might be developed, and I understand that some of these things are quite experimental at this point, but just so that we have some idea of the possibilities, what are some of the things that might be developed that would help draw down our CO2 levels?
Well, in fact, it's not too experimental anymore. So a lot has happened since you and I met about a year and a quarter ago. And the way to look at it is to get the CO2 out, we need a place to put it. And up till now, the scientific community has been asking, how do we get the CO2 out of the atmosphere efficiently? Which is a good question to ask. But a business person, and I'm a business person, you know, in engineering here in Silicon Valley, we in business, you know, you need to have a market. You need someone to buy your product, or it's just not going to happen. And the carbon, the amount that we need to remove, if we're going to get back below 300 by the year 2050, then we need to remove the 7 tons of CO2 every year for every man, woman, and child on the planet. Which is a lot. And I'll tell you two places where we're already buying that amount of CO2. That sentence won't make sense right yet, but you'll see in a minute what I mean. And because once you know where you're going to sell it, where you're going to put it, then it goes very quickly. So the first market for the CO2 is rocks. Globally, we use right now, by coincidence, 7 tons of rocks every year for every man, woman, and child to build our roads and our buildings. Now, it's amazing, but if you realize that rocks are very heavy and we have a lot of roads and a lot of buildings, and with sea level rise, there's going to be a lot more of that used, right? Because we have a lot of cities that need to be raised, then you can begin to see that. Then the relationship between rocks and carbon dioxide is that some rocks, like limestone, which is a great rock for roads and buildings, limestone is 44%. It's almost half CO2 by weight. And creating limestone is not that difficult. If you go to the beach and pick up a clam shell, that is limestone, the clam shell is. And you know, a clam is not really a high-tech machine. It doesn't take a lot of energy. And so here in Silicon Valley, there's a company called Blue Planet Limited, which basically mimics the chemistry inside of a clam and they create limestone out of CO2 from the atmosphere and calcium from various places. And if they've demonstrated doing that, they've put some of their rocks into the San Francisco airport, into the new Salesforce building in San Francisco. They've been approved by Caltrans for building highways in California. And they're opening their first commercial plant for creating this limestone, this synthetic limestone. It's chemically identical, and the properties are the same as regular limestone. It's actually better because there's less dirt, there's less imperfection than quarried limestone. And so that's one process. Once they scale up to produce all the limestone, all the rocks that we use, then in 30 to 40 years, they could actually sequester all of the excess CO2 into our built environment.
That's really remarkable. I just want to take that in for a moment. So you're saying that there is the technology now.
Yes.
To pull this CO2 out of the atmosphere and convert it or sequester it in these rocks that can then be used to build roads and whatever we need.
Yes.
Roads, buildings.
And the delightful part of that is that people pay money for those rocks.
So it could be economically sustainable and advantageous for companies to actually embark on this.
That's right. The big benefit they have is by using CO2 from the atmosphere, they can create the rocks in the city where they're going to be used, you know, for the roads and buildings. Whereas in California, almost half of our rocks now come from Canada and Mexico because we've used up most of the places where the rocks can be quarried.
And hence contributing to CO2 in the atmosphere.
Exactly.
With shipping.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so competitively priced, or it will be competitively priced because they save enormous amounts of transportation cost.
And what are some other things that are on the
table? The other place that we use, that we essentially buy enormous amounts of carbon dioxide is in the byproducts of fish and seaweed in ocean productivity. So in the ocean, you have sunshine photosynthesizing biocarbon, and that turns plankton turns into fish and so on. And a lot of the biocarbon falls to the bottom of the ocean, and we buy the fish and seaweed. Now, most of your listeners probably know that the ocean productivity has gone down. Fisheries are beginning to collapse around the world and have been for many decades, or the last few decades, certainly. And the reason is nutrients, that the ocean has lots of sun, lots of water. But if you imagine you're out in the middle of the ocean, where are the nutrients going to come from? And because, as I said, as the plants and animals die, they sink down towards the middle and the bottom of the ocean. In nature, those nutrients come either from dust, from the air as dust from volcanoes and dust storms, or they come from upwelling from the depths. And by simulating the dust storms, primarily with very fine iron ore, very finely ground iron ore, or upwelling the nutrients that have fallen down to the depths, you can restore the ocean productivity and fisheries. And in the process, there's extremely strong evidence that we can sequester, again, all of the excess CO2 in a matter of 2 or 3 or 4 decades.
So by putting this iron dust, depositing this iron dust on the surface of the ocean, that's providing nutrients for sea
yes.
life to become more abundant, and the fish themselves are sequestering the carbon in their bodies. Am I understanding?
That's roughly correct. Yeah. So a couple things. First of all, people often get a little freaked out imagining distributing iron dust over the ocean, and that's not the way to think about it. Think of it like farming. You would never use one method of farming over a whole continent. You pick a field and you do the minimum intervention in that field, depending on the rivers and soil and so on. In the ocean, it's the same. You pick a pasture, maybe 100 miles in diameter, which is uniform, and then you do the minimum intervention. Iron happens to be a very critical nutrient. That's why it's important in the human diet, for example. And very little is needed. And where that's the limiting factor, it's very easy. In a lot of places, when you get more plants growing, more algae growing, then you also need other nutrients. And then upwelling from the depths where all the other nutrients fall is necessary. And so it's a combination of those. But you think of it as farming, and where you do the minimum intervention, and every year or two, you have a fallow year. You say, we'll just do nothing and let the flora and fauna that was here before recover, and then we'll do our intervention again. Again, just like farming, and really that's what nature does. There's maybe a volcano, maybe a storm, and you get different nutrients, and you get a bloom of something. And then the next year, it's back to normal. And that's essentially what we're doing.
And when you say upwelling, what do you mean?
Essentially pumping. Well, what nature does is there are several ways. Here in California, there are Pacific currents, which tend to pull water from the deep depths up to the coast here, which is why the coast is so cold, because it's getting water from the depths, and then that water moves up and then out back into the surface of the Pacific. That's upwelling. And that's often done with currents, and it's often done with sea life. So whales, for example, they will feed in the depths, and then they'll poop in near the surface, bringing enormous amounts of nutrients up to the surface. It turns out that a lot of sea life does the same thing, that they'll, in the night, they'll go down to the depths, maybe 30 or 100 feet, where all the nutrients are. And then the day when they need the sunlight, they'll actually swim to the surface. And these are just some of them are single-celled animals, I believe, and pick up the sunlight. But that process, again, produces upwelling. It circulates the water. Now that with global warming, that has stopped because almost across the whole ocean, because the warm water is so warm at the surface that the cold water can't get past it. It's just, in a swimming pool, you get the warm water at the surface. And if there's a small temperature difference, you get circulation. But if you get a large temperature difference, then you can't get the circulation.
It's like an inversion.
Exactly. Yes.
So I know that some people, when they hear about these sort of, I'll say, technological interventions, get concerned about us getting heavily involved in geoengineering and what are going to be the unintended consequences of that. Can you speak to that? And what do you say to people around that?
Well, it's a very important question. And everything we do has unintended consequences. Making my fried egg this morning, I spilled some of the butter on the stove and I had to clean it up. every intervention we do is going to have unintended consequences. And of course, every intervention we don't do has unintended consequences. And so the action we take is we stay awake and deal with it. So, I wiped the butter off the stove. It was very easy. No matter what you do in nature, it will always have unintended consequences, because some seed will come by, some animal will come by and change what happens from what you thought would happen, because you hadn't imagined that rabbit would come into your field and eat the field or whatever. And so the way we deal with unintended consequences is we define very clearly the outcome that we want. And once you know what you want, then you're sensitive to any unintended consequences, and then you deal with it. The trick is to deal with it quickly.
And I suppose really what we're talking about right now is dealing with the consequences of our previous interventions in the climate,
which were accidental. They were at the time, we've been a capitalist world for quite a while, and so the goal was to increase capital. And so burning coal and oil and building large factories was, if your goal is to build capital, that's a smart thing to do. What we've realized, as I said in the very beginning, is that the the goal of our climate work is for humanity, the survival and delightful life of humanity. And once you realize that that's the goal, then of course you want a very rich and successful nature. And you want, and that's sort of the bottom line, but the kind of nature that we grew up with. There's an issue I've found where people think that what we want to do on climate work is to take care of nature, which on one level is correct, but on another level you have to be careful, because one could argue that nature will be happiest when it sheds humanity, right? Because we've caused enormous number of extinctions and filth and so on. And so it's not just nature, it's the nature that we evolved for. Yeah, so that's the temperature and the biomes that makes life for humans great, the one that we had 100, 200, 300 years ago.
Because with the trajectory that we're following right now, we don't know that we could even survive as a species.
That's right.
And life on Earth will continue and evolve whether or not we choose to hang around and participate in that.
Exactly.
By dealing with this issue and making it possible for us to stay here.
that's in my evolution, that was the critical discovery. Was Bishop took me to dinner at one of the UN climate conferences, and finally got it through my physicist's brain that climate is about humanity. It's a moral issue about humans, and it's not a scientific issue. As I said, nature will be fine, science will be fine, corporations will do what corporations do, but it's humanity that has a stake in the matter. And then that makes everything easy to understand, that the goal is to bring the planet back to the conditions in which our species and our civilization evolved.
And of course, if we don't, there are a lot of other species that would go down with us. So I'm sort of reminded of, you know, the Noah's Ark story. You know, we're in this boat together.
Oh, that's great.
So in this scenario, it's not just the environmental climate change that we're dealing with, but also the political climate that we're in right now. And at this moment in our history when we really need to be focusing on this and mobilizing around this happens to be also a moment when we're very fractured.
Yes.
So what do you see in our current political climate, and in terms of this vision, what impact do you think that has?
Well, it goes both ways. One of the, you know, I grew up in the 60s, and there was, you know, the population for our planet was way less than a half of what it is now, and there was a lot more open space. It was much easier to grow crops for the people we have. When I grew up, I never worried about was there going to be enough food for my children. At this point, you know, with climate change and with population that the UN predicts will be 10 or 11 billion people in the number of decades, people are very worried. And that's relevant to the political situation, because when you're not worried about survival, the natural thing is to cooperate and collaborate. When we're worried about survival, then it becomes each man and woman and family for themselves. And the world looks like a zero-sum game. And when I look at the politics in our country and a lot of other countries, you know, Russia, for example, it looks like a zero-sum game where those who have the most poker chips are doing their best to keep everyone else away from the board and collect all the winnings for themselves. So on the one hand, it's, you know, we could overcome that in the short term and somehow magically become a more community kind of a community-oriented civilization. Although I'm not into predicting, but that, you know, there isn't much reason to expect that right now. And so one of the big advantages of taking on climate restoration, and a big aspect of climate restoration that people hate to talk about, not hate to, well, avoid talking about, is it also requires having small families for a while to get our, so that our global population gets back to a level that our planet can handle. Paul Ehrlich still lives here in the Bay Area. He wrote the book, The Population Bomb, 50 years ago. And when I spoke to him last year, he said, well, and I asked him, what is the goal for our planet? What can the planet handle? He said, Shakespeare said it beautifully, to be or not to be. That is, most of the experts who have really looked at what does it take to maintain humanity tell us about 2 billion people, or about a quarter of what it is now, which makes sense. I look here at Silicon Valley, and the soils are getting covered with concrete and washing away in the rains and so on, that we're definitely overusing it. And so as we have a vision and see that we can get there, we can actually have a humanity, a planet and a humanity that's a delight to live in, where we're not, where our population is stable, where the resources we're using are consistent with the spaceship Earth that we live on, then life, the future looks really exciting, and cooperation is very appealing. At the moment, the popular thinking is that we're doomed. You know, and when you're doomed, the natural thing is to blame others. I hate to say it, but right. That is the natural thing to do. So
that, or fall into utter despair and become paralyzed and hopeless and sort of give it up.
Yeah. Well, a lot of despair has to do with the feeling that your fate is in others' hands, and therefore you might as well despair because there's nothing you can do. And when you feel like, oh, I can have an impact, then it's pretty exciting to wake up in the morning and get your friends and community lined up to work on the projects that will make life better for your children and future generations.
Yeah. So with the technologies that you're describing, can this project, in your view, move forward with or without the backing? We have a president who wants to withdraw from the Paris Agreement and won't accept the science on climate change. Do you feel like this vision can nonetheless move forward?
Absolutely. It turns out that the two projects I mentioned, pathways. One is sequestering carbon in rock and selling it, and sequestering carbon in biocarbon in the ocean, and then selling the byproduct of fish and seaweed. Those are both lead to a number of viable, possibly reasonably profitable businesses. And so it doesn't require much of anything from the government to make those things happen. It requires, they're both beginning to happen. The limestone aggregate, limestone rock solution is underway, and the ocean stuff, we're getting the pieces together. It was demonstrated about 5 years ago and tested, and then abandoned for political reasons and bad science reasons. It was a big mess. I don't want to go into the details, but we're reorganizing that to be done openly and effectively. So those two projects are beginning to happen. The other thing that's needed now is restoring the Arctic ice. The Arctic is now 80% melted. The Russians send freighters across the North Pole in February, and that impacts the weather that we have here, because the global circulation, the jet stream, all of that is closely related to temperatures in the Arctic, and they're up probably 10 degrees Fahrenheit from what they were 40, 50 years ago. And that's a big reason why we get these long-lasting storms and so on. So it turns out that we have methods for restoring the Arctic ice, which are also not very expensive. I don't know how to make them profitable at this point, but getting either large companies or those countries which are still stable to fund it seems really viable. So all that,
mm-hmm. Or even have you considered crowdfunding?
Yes, yeah, we're actually beginning to work on that as well.
I mean, you know, that seems to be such an amazing development just in the last few years. This possibility for the masses to give a little bit, and it's amazing how much that can add up.
Yeah, and it gets people excited because people need to participate to actually get excited about something. That's why. Even though not that many people go to baseball games and football games, the fact that people do go is what keeps those sports alive. And so, you know, allowing people to participate in climate restoration, that's the challenge that we discovered this month is critical for us. That I'm sort of an egghead by tradition, you know, coming from MIT, and I realize I need to open up and become a little bit more like you and getting the populace involved. Even though the technology is just a few people are going to be doing it, but we can get people, you know, cheer us on and raise money and so on. And people get excited about that.
Absolutely. So what would you say to someone who might claim that, well, but if we find ways to sequester the carbon, what would keep us from then just continuing consuming fossil fuels? Because we've now figured out how to take that out of the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's a common question. You know, if we're taking carbon out of the atmosphere, why can't we just keep burning fossil fuels? And the main answer is, at this point, renewable energy is so much cheaper in most of the world that even the oil companies know that. That they don't have much longer to survive. Some of them are a little slower to figure that out than others, but by 2040, most oil companies realize that they're going to be in different businesses, very different worlds than they are at this point. So it's going to happen anyway. That's one answer. The other interesting answer is, of course, we don't know how quickly fossil fuel consumption is going to go down. And when we do this carbon dioxide removal, we need to design it for the sake of our children and future generations. We need to design it so that we will succeed no matter how quickly or slowly fossil fuel consumption goes down. And it's sort of like once you're building a house, if you want to build a house that's twice as big, it's not that difficult. You know, you need more walls, but it's really... if you need to make it twice as big, you will. Similarly, if we need to remove twice as much carbon as we thought, we'll do it because we'll make the processes twice as big as they were. It'll be a little more expensive, but it's not going to stop us for sure. And so we can say that we will restore the climate no matter how quickly or slowly we switch off of fossil fuels. The critical thing here is bringing everyone along, as we were discussing earlier around the politics and the divisive politics that is predominant now, that the climate narrative has been very divisive, that we've blamed the oil companies, we've blamed the one percenters, and so on. And that's excluded them from participating because we call them the enemy. In fact, in my world, oil companies have been leading in the climate restoration work, you know, very quietly. But Shell Oil was the first company to publish discussion about climate restoration at the beginning of this year. So it's good to realize that they really are our partners. And so what's critical is to frame climate restoration, frame our future as it's for everybody. And the only enemy is just the past. I call it the maturing of humanity because, as you know, when I'm a child, when we're young, we play around and we break lamps and we knock down young saplings and our parents clean up after us. That's because kids do that stuff and there's nothing wrong. And we've been running around the planet knocking, you know, destroying islands and stuff like that. And then we just move on and nature has been our parent. Mother Nature would sort of clean up after us. And now that we've taken over the earth, you know, as I forgot who said it at the in the Gulf War. And the Pottery Barn rule is if you break it, you own it. And so, so we clearly own the earth at this point. So we're the adults. And so it's a maturing process that, oh, we can't just break things and move on. Now we have to plan for what we want for our children. And now rather than a victory over the oil companies, it's simply a victory over the past that we're maturing.
Mm-hmm. And over our ignorance and immaturity.
Yeah.
So what role do you think harnessing our collective imagination plays in all of this and our visioning capacity for this?
Well, that's a big thing that in terms of human behavior, there's sort of, I think of it, there's the psychological perspective and the neurological perspective. And I like the neurological, which is actually about visioning, that when I wake up in the morning, I envision going for my run. And next thing I know, I'm on the road running. My brain automatically takes that vision and creates reality out of it. And, you know, whatever little perturbations are in the way, you know, my running clothes are in the wrong drawer or something. You know, my brain takes care of that. I'd never even notice it, really. And so the visioning is critical for restoring the climate and giving our children and future generations the world we want. Actually, visioning that world is what makes it real. And I assert that one of the failures in the climate has been that we've been visioning the world we don't want. There are all these movies that show the world we don't want. But unfortunately, that's the photograph that's in our brain. And our brain isn't very smart in that way. It doesn't know the difference between what we want and we don't want. And if you notice, our actions have been consistent with going into those dystopian visions.
It's so true. I always remember my driving ed teacher when I was having my first driving lesson, and I got behind the wheel. And he told me, now you will instinctively drive towards whatever you're looking at. And that has always stuck with me, because I totally agree with you. When we're looking at that dystopian future, that is just automatically the direction that we're going to head in. Which is another reason for all the practical reasons that I love what you're doing. I love that it offers us a hopeful vision that we can focus on and support with our cheerleading and our crowdfunding. And,
exactly, you know. Exactly. You know, and the thing that is becoming clear this fall is people are much more amenable to the idea of having a norm of smaller families, because there are three things that we need for the future, for the survival of future generations. We've got to get the carbon back down to levels that humans have lived through in the past. We've got to restore the Arctic ice, because if we don't, then there's going to be an enormous amount of methane and carbon dioxide coming out of the melting permafrost. And we have to get the human population, safely back to levels that our planet can hold. Nature's way of dealing with a exponentially increasing population is a population collapse. We don't want that, and we actually now know that it's easy to have small families. You know, in most of the world, the average family size is less than the replacement rate. And all we have to do is change the norm from an average of two children to an average of one or two children, which is not, you know, it's no, mm-hmm. it's, how to say it, it's not like giving up driving. It's just like, it means mm-hmm. that in this world of a certain amount of scarcity, that if you only have one child, then you know that child is going to have the best health care and the best education in the community. Whereas if you have two or three children, it's going to be a lot harder for you. And so it's actually, you know, so people are becoming more amenable to thinking about that we could actually socialize the idea of one or two kids rather than two or three kids. And that's all it's going to take, along with getting the carbon out and restoring the Arctic, which there are enough of us engaged in it. Those things are going to happen. Although having a cheering section certainly helps.
Yes. Well, I really appreciate you talking with us about all this, Peter. Is there anything else that you'd like to say before we sign off? Anything that you would like us to know in terms of what we can do beyond the things that we've mentioned?
Let's see. The main thing is really just to remember that we're doing this for future generations. That I say that Descartes threw us off the track when he said, "I think, therefore I am." We don't do this for myself to be happy. We do this for humanity, for my community to be happy. It's really for future generations. And when we remember that, then and picture that what we want for our future generations, which I think is what your audience loves to do, that's what's going to make the biggest difference. And to share those futures, those that imagining the redwoods, I'm here in California where we have lots of redwoods, like imagining the redwood forests surviving, you know, many thousands of years more. And you know, our great, great, great grandchildren enjoying that. Talk about that. That's the biggest action that your audience can take.
Yes, and imagine what a great feeling that is to come to the end of your own life and to know that, I say this for all of us, to know that we stepped up to the plate when it mattered.
Yes.
And, things were, there was a lot at stake and we stepped up and did what needed to be done and are leaving a beautiful earth for those to come.
Yes, and exciting, beautiful and exciting.
Beautiful and exciting.
Yeah.
Yes, beautiful and exciting. Well, thank you again, Peter, so much for this conversation. And I encourage our listeners to visit your websites, which are Healthy Climate Alliance and 300 by 2050. I'll have links on the podcast page.
Great. And then we have a new one, which is the overarching one now, is called the Foundation for Climate Restoration. So it's and the number 4 CR is the abbreviation, or they can spell it out longhand.
Okay, great. And of course, I encourage us all to share this on social media so that more and more people become aware of this. And this really does become a groundswell of public resolve that this be so.
Yes.
I'm a Trekkie, and as Captain Picard would say, make it so.
Yes, we will make it so.
Yeah, we will make it so. Well, thank you again, Peter.
Thank you so much. This has been a delight.